fried. Deep fat 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 fried. Hey, everybody, welcome to Deep Fat Motherfucking Fried. Oh, yeah.
Good morning or good evening, wherever you may be.
Yeah, because not everyone's in the same time zone. What's that, Scotty?
What's the show about again?
This show is about how you're always on time for everything. Punctual Scotty.
That's a bullshit episode. I ain't ever on time.
Punctual Scotty.
The
somehow, even when we're doing this remotely, Scotty manages to be later than he is in fucking person. I don't know how.
I'll keep one of that flaw, but you, like, especially you, TJ.
What I do.
If I need something from you and I call you, it's about 50-50 if you're one, if you're going to answer.
Yeah.
And two, if like you're going to get back to me the next day.
Yeah, but you know what?
This weekend. Yeah. Also, TJ, yeah, we had to push back an episode because they didn't do their research.
Hey.
Yeah, so don't.
I was on time.
I throw stones in a glass house, TJ.
I was on time on that episode, though.
Oh, you were on time with nothing.
With bells on. With bells on, Scotty.
Mm-hmm. You're full of shit, TJ. You're just full of shit. You're a goddamn scammer, like everyone says.
Yeah, well. I was complimenting you. I saw how punctual you are, and called you punctual, Scotty.
That was your meaning.
And then you lash out at me. You lash out viciously. I don't understand.
Gentlemen, I don't know why, gentlemen, please. These arguments are unnecessary.
Okay, sorry.
Unnecessary arguments.
Sorry, refined gentleman, Paul.
This is my new accent that I'm affecting when I do the show.
I think it makes you sound more authoritative.
I know. That's why I'm doing it.
It's very impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I appreciate that, TJ.
I'm sure you do.
You have a very impressive bulk about you, TJ.
Oh, yes.
Have I ever told you this?
Highly impressive. Super impressive.
Bulk. Three scoops of bulk.
Damn, three scoops?
Yes.
Wow.
Segmented like an ice cream cone, TJ.
That is true.
Like a triple scoop ice cream cone of a man.
I've never been described that way before, but now that I have, I don't think I'll ever be described any other way ever again.
Yep. I've come to the heart of the matter, TJ.
You can just
you're a four scooper.
Start calling me three scoop.
So, of course, if you're a movie fan, you've heard of the rumors that certain movies and the productions thereof are cursed.
Rumors, huh?
Rumors.
I've always just taken it as gospel truth that these films are cursed.
The reason that I say rumors is because many of these movies kind of cynically adopt the cursed title in order to, you know, drive people to the theaters.
Ah.
But I have combed through the claims and narrowed down some movies that are very obviously cursed for real.
So what are some movies that were they had the claim of the curse, but they didn't hold up to the bullshit test?
Why even mention them, TJ?
Okay.
Why even mention them, TJ?
I was just wondering. Because you said you narrowed it down to some.
Oh, I did.
Okay. But I was wondering what you narrowed out.
I narrowed out every movie except the ones that are actually cursed, TJ.
Oh, okay.
For real. Empirically, provably
cursed. Cursed.
There can be no question. I'm dropping this affectation. It's tiring.
Damn.
Man, I'm so glad I don't sound like a stupid-ass, fucking yuck-mouthed, limey-ass Brit. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Can you imagine being born talking like that? Ugh.
I don't think anyone is born talking like that, necessarily. But
oh, yeah, they are.
Oh, really?
They come right out spitting their stupid Cockney slang.
They even cry, like, in Cockney accents.
Oh, Mom, give me the teat. I'm hungry.
I love it. All right, so what are these cursed? What are they supposedly cursed? I'll be the skeptic here, Paul. I don't believe in curses, Paul.
Well, I mixed these up. We're not doing
convince
anything.
Me.
We're not doing these in chronological order of which they were released. I wanted to kind of skip around a little bit. We're going to start with Rosemary's Baby from 1968.
Rosemary's Baby. Gotcha. So I have the trailer here, or I could just put up an image from the
You can play the trailer and just mute it.
All right, mute the trailer. Gotcha.
So we can get some visuals going.
So this is a Polanski film, and he's super popular these days, as you well know.
I have no problem separating the man from the art.
Right. Maybe that was part of the
that other people tend to have, but
maybe
that
was
part
of the curse, though. I don't know. So this is a movie that kind of it's been aped so many times since in terms of its tone and the atmosphere that it brings and stuff. But at the time, it kind of was a really stood apart from the crowd kind of horror movie.
And it really gave birth to a lot of these kind of devil and possession type of movies. These movies where a demon or Satan is involved. A lot of them owe a lot of their existence to Rosemary's Baby.
This was really a true kind of trailblazer sort of film.
I watched this a couple of days ago to refresh myself on it, and it holds up really, really super well.
Yeah, I mean, it's all based around great performances and suspense and a mystery. So, yes. That kind of thing doesn't really, since it doesn't rely on the special effects of the time too heavily or anything like that, it kind of still works pretty well.
It does.
I like also there's some babies, which is something that's supposed to be like cute and cuddly. It makes it into something insidious.
Oh yeah. Although you don't even see Rosemary's Baby in the movie, do you? You kind of see her.
Get a glimpse of the baby at the very end, of a very quick glimpse of the devil baby. But yeah, it's one of those movies where the big antagonist of the film, or at least the big villain of the film, is never really seen. There are sub villains. The story is basically a young couple. And they move into a building with a dark and mysterious history in New York, where, there have been a lot of suicides and murders and rumors of witch covens having been there. They move into this nice big apartment, kind of a successful young couple, and they're pretty immediately befriended by an old couple that live upstairs or next door to them. It's next door. And after they meet the older couple, they start to get success in their lives. Like, stuff starts happening. Rosemary, the title character, who's played by Mia Farrow in this, she's always wanted to get pregnant. And, pretty soon after moving in and befriending the Cassavetes who live next door, she's pregnant. Her husband, who's kind of a middling, struggling actor that mostly gets kind of commercial work, all of a sudden gets this big role that he's wanted. And everything's kind of coming up roses for them for a while. But slowly but surely, their friendship with the Cassavetes next door takes over their lives. And Rosemary is the only one that has a problem with this. It seems like her husband is immediately happy to, have no friends anymore other than these really old people that live next door. And she has a troubled pregnancy. There was really an attempt, I think, to walk the line between, is what we're seeing happening to Rosemary as she's pregnant and the strangeness kind of ramps up, is it really happening, or is she experiencing kind of a paranoia?
Yeah. So that's, and they never really reveal until the very end,
Right.
Exactly.
And there is a
what's
huge,
happening.
A giant reveal at the end that really leaves no room for speculation.
Yeah. It doesn't end on an ambiguous note. It's like, okay, here's what was going on.
Which is, it's refreshing.
And of course, the only thing about this movie is that it did actually, it was surpassed in every way by its sequel. Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby.
A made-for-TV movie.
That came out a few years later. And totally just blew it out of the water. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They really made I never knew that. They legitimately made a sequel to Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, it's called Look What's Happened to Rosemary's Baby.
It was a TV film too. It was terrible. It was awful. You can't even find a copy of it now. It's very hard to find a copy of because
it's a masterpiece. What are you talking about?
Everybody involved pretty much knew that it was terrible.
Oh yeah, it's so hard to find. I just found the entire movie on YouTube.
Gross.
There you go. Say, look.
That's great.
Hail Satan. Hail Satan.
Fantastic quality, too.
Yeah, terrific.
It's like it was taped right off of a fucking old VCR.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no one went through the trouble of, like, putting out a DVD release of that or anything.
But when you look into cursed movies, this movie is considered by a lot of people, not everybody, to be the most cursed movie of all time.
Wow.
And I guess we can be the judges of that. The box office for this film worldwide was $33,396,740.
In 1968 money. So.
Yeah, that's 1968 money. So an unqualified or an uncontroversial success here. Absolutely, it was a cultural phenomenon at the time. So Rosemary's Baby, based on a book. It was eyed by producers for the film almost as soon as the book it was based on was completed. The director, Roman Polanski, was an agnostic who was skeptical of the supernatural, both evil and benevolent. As I said, he tried to ride the line between the protagonist, Rosemary, having a demonic plot against her baby or the possibility that she was just paranoid. And if I have one kind of criticism of the movie, I don't think he rides that line very well. I think it's pretty obvious watching the movie that, you know, the things happening are not just in her mind. It's pretty on the nose. It doesn't do a really good job of setting up that. Is she just imagining this kind of thing?
By the way, that $33 million it made would have been about $250 million by today's money.
So successful for sure.
Huge success
for a horror movie. That's crazy.
So it appears that the gods didn't appreciate Roman Polanski's skepticism and steeped the cast and crew into bad luck. The actress playing Rosemary, Mia Farrow, was divorced by her husband, Frank Sinatra, right in the middle of filming.
There you go.
So about halfway through this movie, old Blue Eyes decided he was going to dump Mia Farrow and did.
I don't like this bitch no mo.
Which I don't know what he was thinking. His old ass should have hung on to that. He married up for sure.
Yeah, it was Frank Sinatra, though. He had other options.
He had pretty much endless options for
renewal. Yeah, so I mean, like, maybe most men would have regretted that. Probably not him.
Endless options for renewal. Endless options for renewal. Endless options for renewal. Endless options for renewal.
So this is the composer of the film, Christoph Komeda, and in kind of a eerily similar manner to the way several people die in the movie, he slipped into a coma and just kind of passed away of unknown causes after the movie.
Cool.
William Castle, pictured here, who was the producer of this film, got severe abdominal pains similar to the character Rosemary while in the movie. The pain was from demonic spawn. For Castle, it was due to far less interesting but still excruciating kidney stones that led him to be hospitalized.
Oh, fuck.
This experience scared the producer so much that he never made a movie again.
Wow.
So he undoubtedly believed that it was due to the satanic subject matter of Rosemary's Baby that he was cursed with these kidney stones. He later wrote in his memoirs that it felt like Rosemary's Baby was coming true in real life and the cast and crew were being stalked by witches. So this being an old movie, the ultimate resolution of the film is that the Castevets, the next door neighbors of Rosemary and her husband, are in fact in a witch's coven, and they kind of plan things out so that Rosemary will be the mother of the Antichrist. And that, while may not be a super controversial subject matter for a movie now that we've, you know, we're at the back end of a million movies that have tried to set this tone at the time.
Right. This was crazy. Like I said, it was a trailblazer. There was nothing like that at the time.
Right.
I mean, there was no, I don't even, I'm not even, I mean, maybe yeah, there was Wolverine's a movie about
the son, basically the spawn of Satan.
There was any movies about the Antichrist at that time. Maybe there was. I'm not a film historian, but.
Probably so. But.
I can't think of one that predates it. So if there were,
wasn't any that were the cultural phenomenon that Rosemary's Baby was.
Oh, right.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
The worst twist of fate, however, seemed to hit the director of the film, Roman Polanski himself, his wife, Sharon Tate, who is allegedly pictured here. Now, there seems to be some controversy about this, whether or not Sharon Tate appears in this film as an extra. A lot of people say that the woman in the kind of red fur jacket there, the blonde, is indeed Sharon Tate. There are people that dispute this. She was uncredited, only appears as an extra in a scene where Rosemary, who's fed up with spending all of her time with old people, decides to have all her friends over and have a party. But anybody who knows anything about the Manson family knows that Sharon Tate was brutally murdered by the Manson family while she was 6 months pregnant.
And this is Roman Polanski's wife and unborn child.
What?
That's Charles Manson.
That's Charlie Manson, TJ.
I'm saying that Sharon Tate was that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah.
Sharon Tate was.
What you said with the image we saw Charles Manson. We're like,
she was murdered by Charles Manson's family.
Followers, yeah, his followers.
And that was Roman Polanski's wife at the time.
Well, yes, his wife and
his unborn child. I don't know, son, daughter, whatever.
And, unfortunately for us, it was not the Once Upon a Time in Hollywood ending with the Manson family.
No. And this happened, you know, relatively quickly, within 6 months of the release of Rosemary's Baby. And so I think it's the evidence that most people point to. Her being pregnant and dying while so big with child, you know, I think it kind of strikes a lot of people as, you know, part of the curse, considering that Rosemary spends so much of the movie in that state. But it turns out that the devil wasn't done with Roman Polanski yet. Almost 10 years later, the devil fabricated some allegations that he raped and sodomized a child under 14 and furnished a controlled substance to this same child in Los Angeles. Perhaps in a small show of mercy by the fates, Polanski was able to escape to France and avoid extradition to the United States to this day, by the way.
Yes.
Which is super fucking weird.
And he's won Oscars too.
Yeah. He continues to be a filmmaker. He's won Oscars since these allegations. He hasn't set foot on American soil since the late 60s. And or early 70s.
When they kind of extradited him, like it was like 10 years ago. There's a big case, like they lured him to some other country that they would try to extradite him from. He ultimately was not, but yeah, they even tried years and years later. So this hasn't been dropped even now.
Yeah, they've made several attempts to try and get him extradited, but they have been stymied at every turn. So what do you guys think? Curse or just misfortune?
So let's go through once again the evidence behind the curse just really quickly.
Sure.
So he had a composer that fell into a coma and died.
If I remember reading, I read something about this before, like he fell off, like he was at a party and he fell and then he went into a coma and died, I believe.
Okay.
I think so. Yes.
It was something like that. So, I mean, so, like that could, that's an accident.
Mia Farrow's
from what I read, he slipped and fell, was fine.
Okay.
He bumped his head, went to the hospital just to get checked out to be on the safe side, and then while in the hospital, slipped into a coma and died.
Mia Farrow.
Liam Neeson's wife,
right?
Years ago. She went skiing, she hit her head.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm fine. And then later on, she turned out not to be fine. She had brain hemorrhaging and she died. So, I mean, that does happen to people. So I would say with that one, that to me is like, oh, that's a strange coincidence.
Mia Farrow breaking up with her husband, Frank Sinatra.
I mean, marriages fail in Hollywood all the time.
Yeah, but I mean, right in the middle of the movie. How do you explain that? How do you explain that?
She's off. They're not spending time together. He's touring. They're just becoming distant.
Wow.
You know, he's finding someone else.
There comes a point where the skeptic becomes the ridiculous one, Scotty. And you've crossed that line.
I mean, Scotty seems desperate to downplay this.
Desperate to downplay the failed Hollywood marriage.
That's obvious curse.
How about the fact that William Castle, the producer, got fucking kidney stones, Scotty?
And had severe stomach pains, just like the character Rosemary
just
suffers
like her.
Through a lot of the movie.
Yeah. Explain that away, Mr. Skeptic.
People have kidney and abdominal pain.
Real fucking convenient.
How many of those people direct a movie where the devil's baby causes abdominal pain in the main character?
I don't know. Probably not many.
Only one that I can think of.
Exactly. And then Roman Polanski, you know, his wife getting murdered by Charles Manson 6 months or so after the movie. Come on.
And his pregnant wife at that.
Yeah, she's pregnant just like the main character in the movie.
Who, if you look at a picture of her, resembles Rosemary.
That one I'll give you guys. I don't have an answer for that one. That's just a crazy set of circumstances right there.
And then, you know, the devil making Roman Polanski rape that girl.
Planting all that evidence.
I don't think this would cause that.
A scant 10 years after the movie came out. Come on.
10 years later. Come on.
Possessing Roman Polanski and making him perform lewd acts upon a minor. I mean, come on, Scotty. What more fucking proof do you require?
The only set of circumstance in all of that I would say you don't have a good explanation for is the Manson family coming and murdering a pregnant woman. That one that's beyond the pale. There's no other analog or comparison I can think of like, okay, well, that's normal. That could happen. Like, that's the one thing. If you wanted to point to this movie being cursed, that maybe you could get me to go a little bit.
And
like,
you know what's crazy, too? You know, another crazy fucking factor in this curse that Paul didn't even get into is Charles Manson himself, just a few decades later, dead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nick, isn't it crazy? He died, too.
It's crazy shit.
Some people I think actually thought Polanski was in on Sharon Tate being killed for satanic purposes.
Oh, there are tons and tons of rumors about that.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's one thing I remember about that too. Was like, cause this movie was super controversial, so people were saying like, "Oh, well, he basically was a sacrifice to Satan."
Hell yeah, dude. But Roman Polanski, he pretended to be some kind of agnostic, but really, that whole movie was just a giant tribute to Satan.
A love letter to Satan. Come on, let's be honest here.
Okay.
This next movie, though, is a love letter to the other side.
I dropped there for a second. I accidentally clicked out of the window.
Oops.
So it seems like we got ourselves a skeptic here, TJ.
Well, you know what? You know what I think is the perfect cure for that skepticism?
What?
If we think about the Passion of the Christ.
That's right.
Shit, you guys are bringing out the big guns now, huh?
Because we talked about the movie about the devil. But what about the movie about Jesus? This was a way bigger hit even than Rosemary's Baby, even adjusted for inflation. $622 million fucking dollars in 2004 money. I mean, come on.
I mean, they had a big revival moving around this movie, too.
Oh, my God, it was huge. My little sister is a super hardcore evangelical Christian, and she took her two very small children to see this movie, which, you know what I mean? To me, is unconscionable. As much as I wanted to refresh myself on these movies before doing this show, I could not bring myself to watch this movie again.
Fuck no, man.
Not because I'm altogether too disturbed by it, although it is a disturbing movie, but I just find this movie to be boring and plotting and overly focused on the violence. And it just, I don't know. This movie is not a good movie.
This is a movie that just revels in like inhuman cruelty from start to finish. Like it's way more fucked up than like a Saw movie or anything like that.
And the little bits of respite that you get from it are all just like put you to sleep boring.
Yes.
Just I hate that. I think that's one of the weakest criticisms that you can make of a movie. You know, you could ask, well, why is it boring? It just is. It's just a snooze fest of a movie. Very subdued and downplayed performances throughout, with the exception of Jim Caviezel, who plays Jesus, who's constantly screaming in agony. But pretty much everybody else in this movie kind of sleepwalks through it. I don't know. It's just a...
Oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Scotty.
It's the fucking death cult movie. It shows you what Christianity truly worships. So, I mean, to me, it's one of those films where it's like, I see why there's a big hubbub about it, but it's not because the film is actually good. It's just the subject matter of the film. It's like, oh my God, Hollywood made a movie about Jesus. And instead of making one like, you know, what's that movie with William Dafoe where he plays Jesus?
The Last Temptation.
Yeah, The Last Temptation of Christ. Yeah, instead of making it in that way, which might give Jesus an unflattering light or give him qualities that Christians might not necessarily want, this one's just like, he died for your sins. I mean, I agree with you. It's just me and TJ saw it in theaters, and I've only seen it. That's the only time I've ever seen it.
That's the only time I've ever seen it. It's the only time I ever planned to see it.
Yeah, I'll never watch it again. It's a boring movie. I totally agree with you.
It's boring, and when it's not boring, it's disgusting because it's literally just a man getting tortured the entire fucking movie. And it's like it revels in that torture, and it's supposed to make you feel like it's supposed to. There's supposed to be something uplifting about me watching some guy get brutalized, and I'm like, fuck this. Fuck this and fuck everyone who's into this.
It's safe to say that if you're not a Christian, you're not going to take anything of worth away from this movie. How Christians themselves find any kind of meaning, I guess, is a mystery to me. You know, as Scotty was saying, it really does kind of shine a light on the cruelty at the core of Christian faith. So how was this movie cursed?
I don't know.
One thing God definitely doesn't appreciate is blasphemy. True. It is, in fact, one of the things that is forbidden in the Ten Commandments. The Passion of the Christ was steeped in director Mel Gibson's anti-Semitism.
He don't like them Jews.
And God must not have liked his chosen people being smeared. So, you know, there's really no controversy that Mel Gibson is himself an anti-Semite.
I can't. Whoa. There's no controversy. You're just going to fucking declare a man an anti-Semite?
Yes.
Without any sort of defense?
If he wants to come on the show and defend himself, he can.
I'll be his advocate here. Okay. So aside from making a fucking blatantly anti-Semitic movie and making numerous anti-Semitic comments, what has he done to lead you to believe he's anti-Semitic?
I guess nothing if you take those off the table.
Right. Just take that off. So, I mean, come on. Let's give the guy a fair shake here.
If you take his words off the table and his work off the table, I guess he's not an anti-Semite.
Exactly.
I guess you got me there, TJ.
I nailed you.
Hey, didn't we say that we could separate the man from the art?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, the art is actually anti-Semitic too, though. So it doesn't really.
That is true.
We're separating the two. So that's just the time that Mel Gibson went on that tirade. They said Jews caused all the world's wars and they're terrible people.
I mean, it does bear mentioning that the Jews in this movie are portrayed as completely irredeemable, utterly evil, mustachio-twirling villains.
Yes. They're basically, if you're a Jew, you are like Snidely Whiplash.
Yes. So not one but two of the crew of this movie were smited by lightning straight from God during the filming of the movie.
Shit.
So, first off, the lead actor, Jim Caviezel, who played Jesus, was shot with an electric bolt from the heavens after filming the Sermon on the Mount scene.
Fuck, dude. All right, I can't be a skeptic on this
He was let me get this straight. Jim Caviezel was literally struck by lightning?
Yes. He wasn't hit directly, but lightning struck very near him right after the Sermon on the Mount scene, and wasn't injured.
No one took this as a sign, like, God doesn't like this movie, you know?
I mean, look, I'm an atheist and everything, but I mean, at that point, it's all like, they just blasphemed, and it's like, okay, God, if you got a problem with this, strike me down.
It's like, oh.
And God struck him down.
Well, I guess...
I mean, fuck, what other sign do you need?
But as if that wasn't enough, he also dislocated his shoulder while carrying the crucifix in the scene where he carries the crucifix down the Via della Rosa or whatever it's called.
Mm-hmm.
He caught pneumonia during the filming.
Yeah.
And he had an actual portion of his flesh ripped off while being fake whipped.
I guess the whip wasn't as fake as
wasn't
as
fake
he was
enough.
Led to believe. You know, that stuff, you know, whatever. I mean, it was a difficult shoot. Obviously, they put him through a hell of a lot of different stuff. He was bound to get hurt. But the lightning, I mean, that's kind of hard. It's kind of hard to explain away that.
How the fuck do you fake lightning? You know what I mean? That's not something I can just.
The guy that was just up on the screen prior to this picture, TJ, is assistant director Jan Michelini, who was also struck by lightning right after the crucifixion scene.
Oh, gotcha.
So he was also hit by a lightning bolt during the filming of this movie.
Okay, cool. Gotcha.
The next picture is John Debney, who wrote the score of the film. He called the job the most difficult assignment of his life and claims he closely felt the presence of Satan in his studio while he was working on this film score. There were also a slew of tragedies that accompanied the release of this film.
Okay.
On the movie's opening day, this actor, Carl Anderson, who played Judas in Jesus Christ Superstar, so an unrelated movie, but he was, you know, it's the same story. He played Judas. He died on the movie's opening day.
Gotcha.
The film's Kansas advertising sales manager, Peggy Scott, passed away after suffering a heart failure during the film's brutal crucifixion scene. So she was screening the film and died of a heart attack while Jesus was being crucified.
Damn, was that powerful, dude.
But if you're still skeptical, Scotty, let me put the nail in the cross here.
Oh, okay.
This movie made about $662 million worldwide, which is awfully close to 666, isn't it?
That is true.
Damn.
Oh, no, dude, I believe the minute you said God smited them. I mean, the guy playing Jesus,
the guy who was the composer, said he felt Satan in the room with him, you know?
Yeah.
So this movie, obviously, despite its outwardly Christian appearance, is a plot by Satan. I think we can fucking jump to that conclusion.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I guess the question is, was it Mel Gibson himself who made a pact with the devil to line his pockets?
So clearly he's doing fine.
Yeah.
After several legal issues and controversial statements leaked to the public, Gibson's public image plummeted significantly after this film.
Yeah.
And affects his career in acting and directing to this day. He still works. Yeah. But he never really achieved the same level of star power that he had prior to making this movie.
I mean,
so I guess you could say that the final victim of The Passion of the Christ was indeed Mel Gibson's career.
Still got that $425 million net worth, though.
Well, I mean,
when you make the deal with the devil, I mean, the devil's going to give you what you want, but he's also going to take
something. He takes a little price, you know. Devil don't give that shit away for free, you know?
It's going to be done with a twist. You know, come on, it's the devil. He's not just going to give you fucking wealth and fame and success. I mean, that was probably Mel Gibson at his run. He probably kept making deals with the devil, and this last one's like, let me make Passion of the Christ. And it was a huge success, but you know what? His last big success is Passion of the Christ. That's it.
What about Apocalypto?
No one cares about that movie.
I liked it.
Yeah,
no one cares about the movie, TJ.
It's a pretty good movie.
No one's even seen it. You haven't seen it, TJ. You saw a fake version of it.
Oh, did I? Fuck.
Yeah. Studio made a fake one.
I didn't realize that.
Didn't realize that, did
I?
You?
Apologize. I will say this. Mel Gibson, other than that terrible Passion of the Christ, usually a pretty good fucking director.
Yeah. I mean, he's a
great movie.
Yeah, he's definitely talented for sure. I liked him as an actor, too.
Yeah.
He was great in Lethal Weapon.
Riggs.
Great in Mad Max.
Oh, yeah.
Riggs. Riggs, I'm on the toilet, Riggs.
This is The Omen. Very similar to Rosemary's Baby, but this one goes a little bit further than Rosemary's Baby. Doesn't really fucking wrestle with much ambiguity. It's just pretty much outright, like, here, this is the spawn of Satan. What's he going to get up to?
So came out about 8 years after Rosemary's Baby and was obviously heavily influenced by the success of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
The Omen, released in 1976. Made about $48.5 million. So yeah, that's in
76 money. I'll figure out the exchange or whatever.
Sure.
The inflation.
Inflation, yeah.
Another movie that, in my estimation, holds up pretty well. I watched it night before last. I will mention that there is a early 2000s remake of this film.
Yeah.
That is literally worthless. It is a shot for shot remake of the obviously superior original.
Yeah.
It changes almost nothing. It adds absolutely nothing.
No, it's basically exactly the same, except it's shot.
Yeah.
I guess it's just, they just reshot it.
Modern technology. Yeah.
They recast it. They reshot it. The actors that they recast in the film, inferior. every shot is inferior. Every plot development is
the overall atmosphere way inferior.
It's just absolutely awful. And, yeah, I mean,
it's literally almost every single plot point. I don't know that they changed much of anything. I can't, you know, you'd think that when you do that, you'd have something that's like approaching the same level of quality, but no.
No.
By the way, adjusted for inflation, that's about $221 million.
So another gigantic success.
Yes.
A little bit of trivia about this movie. 666 prior to this movie was not a huge cultural thing as it relates to the devil.
Right.
It was, in fact, this movie was originally called The Birthmark, which right. I think they were smart to change it to The Omen.
Yeah.
And you see that 666 in the O there.
Yes.
Yeah.
But no, War of the Beast.
So also, this movie is likely responsible for the name Damien being associated with Satan, Satanism.
Well, it's because it sounds kind of like demon.
Right.
Damien, but up in, demon.
Before this, know. Damien is not even a biblical name. Right. It has absolutely no connotation in Christianity. And what? This movie is responsible for that name becoming way less popular.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So for those that haven't seen this movie,
By the way, if anyone out there is remotely curious, sorry to interrupt, Paul, but the name Damien is a Greek, comes from Damianos, which means to tame.
Sure.
There was actually a Saint Damien who was martyred with his twin brother Cosmo in Syria in early the 4th century.
Damn, Cosmo, that's a cool
Cosmo.
Name.
So this is the kid, I guess, when he's not trying to look terrifying.
Well, I mean, this is the final scene of the movie.
Oh, okay.
And after you have learned what Damien is,
so
which,
of course it has
spoiler.
Yes, some of the
Damien. He's the Antichrist. The smile, which looks sweet and unassuming on the face of it, becomes a very sinister thing.
Gotcha.
He, in fact, if you go back to that picture, he's at the funeral of his parents.
Right. So that kind of changes it. But I mean, in most of the scenes of the movie, he's trying to look pretty freaky, or he's trying to look, oh, I'm an innocent little kid.
Yeah, trust me.
By the way, this kid was a pretty good child actor, because most of them are pretty awful.
I didn't take notes about it, but some of the things that I learned was that he was absolutely a hellion on set.
Well, that kind of makes sense, right?
That's good.
And in order to get some of these reactions out of him and to get him to give some of the looks that he did, the director of this film would insult him. Like, he would say, "You little twerp, I'm going to punch you in the face," and then he'd start rolling. But apparently this kid literally, you know, loved to run onto set and ruin shots and was very obstinate and liked to kick people and pull their hair and shit.
Well, I mean, it kind of makes him right for the role, though, you know?
I guess so.
But he was, I mean, whatever, you know, they got the performance they needed out of this kid. So.
They did indeed. I love this promotional shot from the movie. It doesn't actually appear in the film, but, you know, the shadows creating inverted crosses is, you know, it's just a cool shot.
It is cool.
So this 1976 movie is about a man who realizes that his adopted son is the Antichrist. Now, kind of in a twist, he's the only one that knows that the kid is adopted. So he finds out on June 6th of 1976 at 6 a.m. that his child, who was born in a hospital in Rome, died shortly after childbirth. He shows up to the hospital and doesn't know how he's going to tell his wife. I guess back then, the father found out remotely before the wife did.
Yeah, gotcha.
And he's given the option by a priest there to adopt a little boy whose mother had died in childbirth that same night and not tell his wife about it. And he decides to go forward with that. So this movie all began with Robert Munger. He was a born-again Christian who pitched to Hollywood the idea of an Antichrist movie in the wake of Rosemary's Baby. So it was very nakedly like, hey, let's cash in on this Satanism thing. You know, there hasn't been a really good, well-regarded Satan movie since Rosemary's Baby. That did really well. You know, we've got this the script for a movie. Let's make this. Harvey Bernhard agreed and signed on to make The Omen a reality. However, once the idea began gaining steam, Robert Munger seemed to backtrack on the idea. In fact, he said, I warned Harvey at the time. I said, if you make this movie, you're going to have some problems. Bad if the devil's single greatest weapon is to be invisible, and you're going to do something which is going to take away his invisibility to millions of people, he's not going to want that to happen.
Oh, shit. The devil's like, I don't think so, bitch.
So this is Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
Star of the movie. And the beginning of this movie's filming started off with a literal bang. Gregory Peck took off in October 1975 to begin filming the movie. His plane was struck by lightning.
A lot of lightning.
Yep. An ominous start to The Omen. The lightning strike actually caused an engine on his plane to catch fire, and the plane came dangerously close to having to crash land in the Atlantic Ocean, which is almost certain death.
Yes, you're dead.
Just a few weeks later, Mace Neufeld, a producer, was on his way to film, and his plane was also struck by lightning while crossing the Atlantic.
Okay.
And because all things happen in threes, screenwriter David Seltzer, who was riding on the plane towards the set as well, you guessed it, non-fatal lightning strike on his plane. So three people involved in the production of this film had their planes struck by lightning before the filming even started.
Damn.
Gregory Peck's son committed suicide just before the filming of this
This is not started. Gregory Peck's son on the screen, by the way.
No, this is not. This is a producer, Harvey Bernhard. And he, as if there wasn't enough lightning already, was almost struck by lightning while a scene was filming in Rome.
You know, lightning strikes are a pretty rare occurrence. So
yes.
For people, yeah.
For planes, I guess planes do get struck more than people do. So.
It says, jetliners in the U.S. are struck by lightning once every 1,000 flight hours or once each year on average.
I mean, so that's still pretty crazy.
To have three of these happen.
Yeah, that's
all related to one movie.
Yeah, that's it is pretty crazy.
But this is, of course, assuming that this isn't some Hollywood mumbo jumbo as well. Like, yeah, everyone just say your plane got struck by lightning.
Right.
Yeah. You know, because, I mean, like, you can't put it past them to do that.
As if there wasn't enough plane drama surrounding this, the crew was on the list to hire a small local plane to get some aerial shots for The Omen. However, at the last minute, the plane's crew decided to nix that kind of reservation for the plane and rented it to a group of tourists instead. Now, I wasn't able to fully vet this, but it seems that a lot of people believe this happened. It was several people on a business trip that ended up getting this plane rental. The Omen crew was told that they could have the plane, but they'd have to wait until a day later to film in it. The plane the crew was supposed to be on crashed. Upon takeoff, it flew into a flock of birds. The birds disoriented the crew, obstructed the view, and the plane crashed through a fence and into a car, killing everybody on board.
Cool.
Okay.
Lactose!
All right. If I was in this movie, I would never go on a plane again.
Yes. The IRA, the Irish Republican Army, also played a role in this curse. This is executive producer Mace Neufeld. He and his wife were staying at the Hilton Hotel in London, and the IRA blew up the building. Thankfully, neither of them were in the hotel at the time. So there was a bombing attack on the hotel that the producer and his wife were staying in. And just a few days later, the IRA struck again. Several producers, Neufeld and movie star Gregory Peck, were headed to a restaurant that the IRA bombed just minutes before their arrival. So he narrowly misses dying in an IRA bomb at his hotel. And then a day later, he's going out to dinner and narrowly misses dying in a bombing at the restaurant he was headed to.
You know what? The thing about this, if this is like the devil behind all this, you know, it kind of makes the devil into like a comedically inept sort of villain, doesn't it?
Maybe he was just trying to send a message, though. Maybe he wasn't necessarily trying to kill anybody. He was just trying to, you know, warn them to stop this production.
But he keeps trying to get these guys. And
I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure why the devil would want to stop this production, because the devil wins in this movie.
Right. Yeah. The whole point of the movie is like the devil fucking prevails and is awesome.
Right. They're looking at it the wrong way. This is God warning them.
Yeah, I think this is God trying to stop it, but he's so inept, he just can't do it. He's like sending his lightning down, but
maybe it's because God is the good guy and he doesn't want to kill anybody, and that would make more sense if it was God.
Yeah, he's trying to
trying to warn them away.
Well, God killed all the people on the other plane. I mean, he said you can't prove that. That's not 100% verified.
But those were just normal people. We're not talking about Hollywood people who are worth more than normal people. Yeah.
So. Worth 10 times their weight of the average person.
Anybody who works in the movie industry is worth like 20 of you or me, you know.
Right.
Everyone knows that.
One of the biggest, as if we hadn't heard enough, one of the biggest arguments for a curse in this movie happened to the special effects director, John Richardson, and his assistant, Liz Moore, who were involved in a serious car accident that actually decapitated Liz Moore.
The
gruesome incident, what happened on... Now, listen to this. Listen to this string of coincidences. Gruesome incident happened on Friday the 13th, 1976. It mirrors one of the Omen's most violent scenes. By the way, if you go and watch this movie, it has what I consider to be one of the best decapitation scenes ever filmed.
Yeah, it does have a good one.
It's incredibly shocking and quick and... unexpectedly violent.
I think the only one I've seen that was, I think, actually surpasses it wasn't until I watched Hereditary.
Yeah.
Because I thought that had probably the most brutal decapitation I've ever seen in a movie.
It's definitely reminiscent. It's just a very quick, brutal, unexpected decapitation. But check this out. Where they got into a crash was in the Netherlands. And there was a roadside right by where they crashed for the town of Ommen, O-M-M-E-N.
So one letter away from being Omen.
Right. And the town was 66.6 kilometers away.
Oh, my fuck. Okay. All right. The last one, Rosemary's Baby, I was like, well, the guy could have slipped and fell. It's like, this is some crazy fucking shit.
Yeah.
This is insane. He was decapitated in a town town called Omen. That was
66.6 kilometers away. Boom! Decapitation just like in the movie, bitch.
What the fuck, dude?
Terry Walsh, and this kind of related to the picture that's up here. There's a pretty famous scene in the movie where the lead characters are attacked by a pack of rabid Rottweilers. By the way, Rottweilers actually became a popular breed because of this movie.
Yeah.
They're featured throughout. And before this movie, they were a very, very, you know, small, hard to find breed. And people just all wanted Rottweilers after this film.
Cause they're fucking intimidating.
Yeah. And they are very intimidating in the movie. So Terry Walsh, who plays a supporting actor in the movie, his stunt double was badly injured while filming the dog attack scene in the cemetery and had to be hospitalized.
Well, Rottweilers, so these dogs, they have some pretty powerful jaws. I think most powerful jaws.
They were very well-trained dogs, and the trainers were flabbergasted that the dogs had gone apeshit and tried to kill him.
Right.
There was also an unverified rumor, and I didn't really pull it, but I'll mention it here. There's a scene in the movie where baboons attack a car carrying the little boy Damien and his mother. They're driving through these safari thing, which I guess used to be a thing. I guess you used to be able to go to these safari parks where you could drive your car, you know, into the pens of wild animals, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's a famous scene in the movie where they're in a baboon pen and the baboons go ape shit.
Right.
And the unverified rumor was that the baboons during the filming actually went ape shit and hurt a couple of the people that were on the set. Now, I couldn't verify that, so I didn't pull it.
I'll be right back. Hold on.
Okay. Damn, TJ.
What the hell, man?
How's TJ just going to leave?
Dude, I think your fucking shit got to him, dude. He's probably like, oh my God.
He's going to go splash some cold water on his face.
It's not real.
Now, Rosemary's Baby was like, yeah, Passion of the Christ, like a little bit more so. I mean, I see what you're building. I mean, the omen here, I mean, this is just, going beyond coincidence, this is just like everyone that was, not everyone, but a lot of people involved in this movie, some of the principal actors, the producers, stuntman, just like everyone was getting fucked up on this film.
Yeah. I mean, I did try and ramp things up as we went along. And the omen... Because of all these things, The Omen is once again considered by a lot of people to be the most cursed film of all time. I think that, you know, Sharon Tate getting killed by the Manson family really boosted Rosemary's Baby.
Yeah, but that happened. That's something that happened afterwards, too.
Right.
You know, this is all stuff that's happening during the production of the film. And, like, look, accidents happen during, you know, film production. And if one of these things happened, that would be a big deal. Like, oh, someone's plane crashed. Are they almost gotten a plane in the crash? But just having... so many lightning strikes on planes, which, you know, with the best, I mean, now the benefit of like having science and technology and advancing as much has told us about, that's about once a year occurrence on average. Now it can happen more, of course, but having three times, having a plane they're about to rent crash, having baboons, you know, these dogs attack a stuntman, almost killing him.
Yep.
Bombings. I mean, just every fucking thing.
Beheadings.
Yeah, beheadings. 6.6 kilometers away.
Yep.
I guess in miles, maybe it's a little, it's not the same.
But, sorry.
Yeah, the most world uses kilometers.
So as we were doing that, Salvador, for some reason, started going ape shit. So I think the I think the curse just continues.
Dominoes.
Lactose domino. Yeah.
Yeah, this movie does have a pretty cool soundtrack. There's a Latin kind of chant that happens throughout all the songs.
Like
the
Gregorian chant, like, ooh.
It's Bibimus sanguinus edimus corpus, which is drink the blood and eat the body.
There's our 5 seconds that were allowed.
Very Catholic sounding chant.
The final little piece here is that the film actually violated sacred ground by filming in an actual archaeological site of an old temple in Jerusalem.
Which we're looking at here, I believe.
Yeah, this is a shot from that. And it was controversial at the time. The authorities in Jerusalem did not want this to happen, and it happened anyway.
So I guess they just said, fuck you, authorities.
So it's hard to imagine a movie being more cursed than The Omen. I mean, you know, we've just gone through again all of the things that happened on The Omen. Beheadings, lightning strikes, death, dismemberment, suicide, bombings. I mean, it's hard to conceive of a film that could be more cursed. But we haven't talked about Atuck yet.
And this movie, this does not exist, correct?
Movie does not exist.
This movie never even happened.
So cursed that it was never made. So we don't have a trailer to show you. We don't have any film footage to show you or screenshots to show you.
But this is the cover of a book, obviously, that they're trying to adapt here. I've never heard of this book. It's by Mordecai Richler.
The incomparable Atuck. It's kind of a comedy book, social satire book.
It kind of looks sort of like it might have sort of a like Confederacy of Dunces vibe to it, maybe.
Well, it's about an Eskimo. Now, TJ, I want you to control yourself.
All right,
control yourself.
I've been going to counseling. They're trying to get me, you know, to get over my quote unquote, you know, bigoted view of Eskimos, and you know, But, you know, look, I mean, this curse, though, doesn't that kind of just show you?
TJ.
All right. Stop. I'm sorry.
Your anti-Inuit sensibilities are going to bring this podcast down. This is the woke era, TJ.
I didn't mean to fucking insult the Inuit shits.
God damn it, TJ. This episode. No, you know, we're going to edit this episode down now.
Yeah. You go do that.
I can even release this section now, TJ.
I thought this was just a dude wearing a costume. I didn't know this was supposed to be this. I don't know. This was some legit fucking disgusting ice chucking piece of garbage.
TJ, stop it.
All right, I'm sorry. I know we're not allowed to fucking speak the truth anymore about these fucking degenerate igloo dwelling pieces of. All right, I'm sorry.
Your dialogue is going to be this for this part of the section.
Yep. It's just going to be a long fart every time you talk.
Stop it, TJ. What's wrong with you, man?
So this book is about Atuk. He's transplanted to Toronto from his native Baffin Island. He's a poet. He's an unlikely overnight success once he gets to civilization.
Is this guy a Canadian?
Yeah, Canadian Eskimo. Now Scotty's going to start.
What the fuck, Paul? You got too fucking far. They're bad people, Paul. They're all bad people. You can't trust them.
Why do you guys hate our neighbors to the north so much?
Hey, I don't got nothing against Canadians.
They burned the White House down, Paul.
Canadians
burned the White House.
You know, Scotty's fucking totally bigoted view of Canadians has nothing to do with my completely rational hatred of Eskimos, all right?
TJ, so don't even burn down the White House? No.
Don't even compare the two things.
You know, one of the...
Go ahead, Scotty.
These actual grievances you could bring about the Eskimos, TJ, is they're all drunks.
Well, that's one of
Jesus. Both of you?
Paul, they do legitimately have a drinking problem in those parts of Canada. They do.
God.
Damn.
I'm sorry. It's true.
Brutal. Scotty's brutal.
I'm brutal for telling the truth?
Brutal. So what the fuck is this book about?
A promotional kind of thing for the book says, Mordecai Rickler's hilarious and devastating satire lampoons the self-deceptions of the Canadian identity and derides the hypocrisy of a nation that seeks cultural independence by slavishly pursuing the American dream. That's basically about an Eskimo that moves to the big city and all the wacky things he gets up to.
Well, bop-a-dop, bop-a-dop.
Gotcha. Apparently a really good book. It was immediately seized upon by Hollywood, but I'm letting you guys know this may be the most cursed movie that we talk about today because it is so cursed it was never made, and this is going to blow you guys away. So the screenplay, based on the satirical novel The Incomparable Atuk, about an Eskimo who moves to New York City. It's actually not New York City; it's Toronto.
Well, I'm sure that when the movie people got a hold of it, they turned it into New York.
They turned it into New York. It's been kicking around Hollywood since 1971 when the producer pictured here Norman Jewison.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Where's Mel Gibson when you need him? All right.
TJ.
Yeah, I'm TJ.
It's going to be poor Taylor's going to have to edit so many fart noises into this.
Yeah, I'll do it.
So Norman Jewison here bought the book right.
I'm going to mute my mic for a second.
TJ loves this name, Norman Jewison.
His name, TJ, got a problem with his name?
No, I sure don't.
You like his last name especially? Jewison, what's the problem with it, man?
I don't know what's funny about a Hollywood producer named Norman Jewison. I don't know. There's nothing really funny about that at all. Oh God, no. All right.
So pretty much all of the major actors who were attached to this project at various times died, and they're all big names. This is
Jim Belushi.
Yep. So this is Jim Belushi. He read the script and was interested in the role, but he died of a drug overdose in 1982 before he could start filming.
Okay. Yep. And then who was next?
It goes on.
Sam Kinison.
Sam Kinison was tapped to play the lead in 1988, even actually reportedly filmed a few scenes of this movie. But the production fell apart due to disagreements between the actor and pretty much everyone else. And he died in a car accident not long after the production was halted.
So, but they didn't really like what he was doing with it anyway. They're like, oh, God, you don't really get this. And he's like, no, you don't get it.
Doesn't stop there. You guys thought John Candy died of a heart attack? No.
Died of Atuk.
Fuck.
I think maybe I'm starting to see why. Why this didn't work out, because they kept trying to cast really, really fat dudes.
Yeah.
And we're not a long-lived race of people.
It's true. It got passed to John Candy. So a number of years later, in 1994, John Candy was tapped to play Atuck. Candy took the script completely unaware that it was cursed, and he promptly died of a heart attack.
Fuck.
After this, the screenplay was buried in Hollywood, and all chubby comedians swore to stay clear of the film for good.
That makes sense. I mean, when three fat fucking comedians who were scheduled to play this shit, you know, died, it's like, you know, you gotta take that seriously.
I even hear a rumor to you that Chris Farley might have been offered the role.
That's actually true. No, it really? Is. It is. Before we get to that, Michael O'Donohue, who was a friend of Candy's, and according to the rumors, went over the script with the actor, had a cerebral hemorrhage, and died not long after John Candy.
Okay.
And in 1997, another abortive attempt to get Atuck the Incomparable made. Chris Farley was tapped. He was in talks for the lead role and died of an overdose.
But it's not over yet.
And
what Phil the Hartman. Fuck?
Yep. Phil Hartman was also attached to the script at one point, and his wife killed him.
Yeah, so finally they're like, okay, no more fats. Let's have a fucking
Let's
skinny.
Let's try a skinny. Nope. Yep. Dead too. So basically anybody, you don't even want to fucking, if this script comes across your desk, run.
Yep.
Just run away.
Fire, dude. You burn that shit.
If you're a fat actor, this script should never come across your desk. Your people should never even mail you this script. It's over. So this movie will likely never be made due to the, you know, just horrible luck and many deaths that just talking about it has caused.
Dude, we should try to make this movie, next. Paul.
I'm not starring in it. You Paul, can star in it.
You can play Atuck, Paul.
No, I think you would do better, TJ. I think it would actually be therapeutic for you to play an Eskimo.
No, I think actually, you know, you already got that kind of Eskimo look and countenance and shit, and I think you're the right weight for the role. You know, plus you're a terrific actor, Paul, and you got a great comedic timing. I think you'd be perfect.
The role is just too big
to bring Atuck to life.
Pass, TJ. I pass on that.
So I'm hearing that you're attached to the project.
No, I'm
that's
not.
What I'm hearing. Hear that, universe? No. Paul's ego is attached to play Atuck. Just letting you know.
You heard wrong, TJ. You heard wrong.
So, yeah, that's A-tuck. Crazy one.
So, our final movie, another
by
one.
By the way, that one, of all the ones that were cursed, that one actually convinced me more than any other that it was cursed.
I don't know, man. The Omen is pretty hard to beat.
The Omen, I don't know. I think just the sheer death toll of that, of famous actors who couldn't even, it wasn't even like, that movie is so cursed that the movie wouldn't even allow it to happen. Like, if you even read that script, you're dead. It's like the fucking Ring of a script, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And for a stupid little, like, comedy movie about an Eskimo in the big city, too.
Right. And it's got, like, that's the weird thing is, like, all these other movies have, like, a pedigree of, like, this. Like, I can understand why the supernatural forces of the world were pissed about this one. But
demonic connotations.
Right, but Atuck, the fucking Eskimo? I mean, what the fuck?
Maybe, TJ, the Eskimos will be the destroyer of humanity. Maybe we all, and maybe God knows that. It's like, if this movie's ever made, Eskimo culture will rise to prominence.
Yeah, maybe.
And soon, humanity will self-destruct, man. Can't do it.
Could be. Fuck.
So our last movie that we're going to talk about today is Poltergeist.
Poltergeist.
Yeah, this movie scared the shit out of me as a kid. Like, I was pretty much convinced this movie was real.
yeah, it scared the shit out of a lot of people. This is a really frightening movie, honestly.
Especially considering it's not even an R rating.
Released in 1982, made about $121,700,000 worldwide,
which is about $326 million.
So
inflation.
The second most popular movie that we've covered today.
Other than Passion of the Christ. What is this shit? I haven't seen a fucking banner ad on a YouTube video in forever.
Yeah, is that a new thing that they're starting up again?
Yeah, I guess they might be. I guess they must be bringing it back because I just fucking had to click off of one. So.
Shit.
Whoa. Crazy.
So, you know, Scotty said this movie scared the pants off of him as a kid. I think it scared a lot of kids.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, and it's a very simple concept for a movie, too. It's just a family that is pursued by ghosts and shit and haunted. There's not a whole lot more to it other than that. Really well done. Steven Spielberg movie, one of the only horror movies that he was ever personally involved in directing. And unlike the other movies on this list, The Curse extends to the sequels for the films, too. It's a very broad-ranging curse mythology that doesn't just include the original Poltergeist, but also 2 and 3. I actually, and a lot of people hate the third Poltergeist. I really like the third Poltergeist movie. The first two all kind of center around just a normal suburban home, and the third one takes place in a skyscraper, like a haunted futuristic skyscraper, which, you know, I don't know. I think that's a pretty cool concept.
Yeah.
Definitely take it to a new direction. I mean, like, and a lot of times you see that with these movies. It's like either you see them do the same formula or they just get so outlandish, like, now we're in space. But Poltergeist 3 is a pretty good movie.
I don't really remember much about Poltergeist 3, honestly. I've seen it, but I don't really remember it very well.
It's pretty good.
Fucking doll, dude. Oh, that fucking doll, man.
Yeah, is that what did it to you? The clown?
Yeah, dude.
For me, it was the damn...
about that clown doll in this...
Oh, God.
In this segment here.
For me, it was that damn tree.
Oh, the tree did you in?
The tree, the Robbie's braces coming to life. That's a very memorable scene. You remember when his braces
wasn't that in the second one? I thought that was the second one.
That was in the second one, yeah.
Yeah.
There's also a really cool scene in the second one where the dad gets drunk and drinks some mezcal that has the worm in it. You remember that scene?
I don't.
He drinks a whole bottle of mezcal, you know, the kind that has the little worm at the bottom of it.
Right.
And then he pukes up all of the mezcal and pukes up the worm, and it becomes this giant bloated demon worm that chases him through the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So, brief synopsis, a young family's lives are turned upside down when malevolent ghosts invade their home and their daughter is abducted by evil spirits. So a lot of, kind of curse mythology around this. This is probably one of the creepier performances in a horror movie, by the way, the preacher Kane, and he's involved in this as well, as we'll see. But let's start down the curse road, shall we? Why is this movie cursed?
Okay.
So Dominique Dunn, who's pictured here on the far right, she played the older sister in the Freeling family, was the first of the cast to die in an untimely fashion. Dunn broke up with an abusive boyfriend who later returned to her house to pressure her into getting back together with him. She refused. And an argument ensued. The argument escalated, and the ex-boyfriend choked her until she passed out and fell into a coma and died.
You want to hear something crazy?
What?
You bring this up. The first time we all met in L.A., that was the house we stayed in.
We stayed in the Poltergeist house?
Where that woman was murdered, yeah. I looked it
up. Oh, yeah, that's right.
You remember that shit?
That is right.
Yes, we actually have stayed in that house.
So we didn't stay in the house, the Poltergeist house. We stayed in the house that Dominique Dunn was staying in when she was murdered.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. You're absolutely right.
West Hollywood, California. Yep.
I remember that. Oh, cool. My God.
So we actually were all at the place where she was murdered.
Yep.
But not where she died, because she didn't die until later in the hospital in a coma.
Well, yeah. But you mean that's...
But where she was strangled into a coma.
She was killed shortly after production of the film. She died in 1992 at the age of 23.
Thank you.
Sorry.
So even worse, the ex-boyfriend who did the murder was released after serving less than 4 years. So that's a tragedy. And if that was the only thing that happened, there probably wouldn't be a curse mythology around this movie.
Yeah,
but
I'd just be like, oh, that's an unfortunate fucking piece of trivia.
Poltergeist was not done yet. This is Heather O'Rourke, who played Carol Ann in all three of the movies. She's probably the most common person to be brought up when people talk about the Poltergeist curse. She was diagnosed with Crohn's disease, which is an intestinal disease, earlier in her life, but it turned out to be a misdiagnosis. In fact, Heather O'Rourke had a bowel obstruction that caused her to go into septic shock. Unfortunately, the symptoms of the shock were incorrectly attributed to the flu, so another misdiagnosis, and she was not immediately treated for it, and she died at just 12 years old as the obstruction released toxins into her bloodstream. So she died of sepsis, basically.
Fuck, dude. Having no luck. Like, oh, no, you're fine. Oh, you got the flu.
Series of misdiagnoses.
Her character is central to the storyline of all three of the films. It's kind of implied that she's psychic and that these ghosts need her as a conduit to bring them back into the mortal world. So that's her place in the film. So definitely the central character of all three of the movies. The unexpected and shocking nature of her death, and so young too, made many believe that this curse was real. So she died in 1988. This is Julian Beck, who played the preacher Cain. A lot of people, you know, kind of poo-poo this one as being a part of the curse. He was already battling cancer during the filming of Poltergeist and Poltergeist 2. Or sorry, he was just in Poltergeist 2. He played the evil preacher Cain. He died a few months before the film premiered. So maybe not a curse there. But yeah, he was already if you take it into totality, he just adds to the number of untimely deaths surrounding this movie. And if he was the only person to die after appearing in the franchise, it wouldn't seem to be connected. But because he, like many others who acted in Poltergeist, suffered from an illness or incurred other misfortune, he's counted as evidence nonetheless. By the way, I pulled a picture of the replacement for Kane that appears in Poltergeist 3, and it doesn't really work as well.
Well, they didn't. It's hard to replace this. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually has that really truly gone face because he's actually battling an illness. Yeah, and 3, that's just no.
Doesn't need a lot of makeup to make himself look creepy, and this dude is clearly in tons and tons of stage makeup. Richard Lawson, who played Ryan in the original Poltergeist film, is believed to be another victim of the curse. He's on the right here. Lawson is still alive and well, but in 1992, he boarded flight 405 to Cleveland. Many passengers on board reported feeling uneasy before the flight. Lawson was bumped to first class after a flight attendant recognized him, a chance encounter that probably saved his life because the plane crashed into the bay after a failed takeoff. Most of its passengers were trapped in their seats. 27 of the people on the plane died, including someone in Lawson's original assigned row. So if he hadn't been bumped up to first class, it was probably curtains for him.
Wow.
Narrowly escaped death. Another plane incident.
Stay away from planes, goddammit.
Yeah. In a way, you could say the movie saved him.
Maybe so, yeah, because he was recognized because of it.
The movie giveth and the movie franchise taketh away.
So this one's for you, Scotty. This is Oliver Robbins, who played Robbie. He was reportedly attacked on set by the mechanical clown.
Fuck.
In a scene where he was supposed to be struggling with the creepy clown, it malfunctioned and started to choke him out.
Scotty's leaving.
I fucking knew that thing was evil, man. I fucking knew it was evil.
Yep. Because the scene was meant to show a struggle, many members of the cast thought that his reaction was just acting, and it wasn't until he began to turn blue that they jumped in and intervened and saved him from the fucking clown.
What the fuck?
So he was almost just strangled to death by this evil, demonic clown puppet doll thing. He survived the attack. He's still alive. He's 47 as of the time of this filming. And he's currently involved in the production of a documentary about the many deaths connected with the franchise as a means to lay the tragedies from this time in his life to rest. So he's kind of spearheading a forthcoming documentary about all the people who died on Poltergeist.
Yeah, and Spielberg went on to direct Ready Player One, so he obviously too was affected by the curse.
Yeah, yeah. There's the curse. So good. that's all of the cursed movies that we have talk about.
I still got to say, for my money, A-Tuck is still the most cursed, just because of the amount of A-list celebrities that it killed just for reading the script. I mean,
right. I would say A-Tuck and The Omen definitely are our most cogent arguments for the existence of a curse surrounding a film. Now, it bears mentioning, kayfabe aside, at the end of this, that a lot of these movies embraced this idea of a curse.
Well, why wouldn't you? I mean, it's a fucking, it's a sales point.
Right. Rosemary's Baby did, The Omen did, and Poltergeist. All three of these movies in promotional materials and just as a general function of the people that were that owned the properties have kind of embraced the cursed rumors in order to drive people to watch and see and consume the products of the movie. But you know, an interesting thing, four of the five movies that we talked about had, you know, at least spiritual, if not Christian subtext in them.
Yeah. That's, but the most cursed was A-Tuck. Don't fuck with those Inuits, dude. They got Inuit curses. They can fucking chant at you.
I didn't believe until the clown thing, man. The clown almost fucking killed that dude. Yep. At that point, I mean, look, plane crashes, bombings, whatever you want to say, you know, people reading scripts and dying, TJ. That fucking clown took matters into its own hand. And TJ, you had to have all your toys hid, all your dolls, when you were a kid because of Chucky, man. But you should have been. This is the fucking movie that made you should have made you fucking do that.
And think about that too, dude. Like, you're on set, this thing starts choking you, and Steven Spielberg is like, "Wow, this is great. Keep rolling." You know what I mean? He really looks like a star.
So I know someone's probably going to try to correct you and say, actually, oh, it was Toby Hooper or Tom Hooper or whatever the fuck his name was that directed.
Oh, yeah, Toby Hooper directed. It was just a Spielberg produce.
Well, but actually, I've read that Spielberg actually did direct the movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they said that Spielberg actually, I guess, Hooper, I can't remember if it was Tom Hooper or Toby Hooper. Because there's Toby Hooper. There's directors, both, whatever. But anyway, I guess he wasn't doing a good job, or something was going on, or he just didn't command the proper respect, or something happened where, anyway, Spielberg basically took control, but let Hooper keep the credit. So actually,
there's a whole process. I'm sorry. There's a whole process with the Directors Guild of America to change credits for a movie, and it's probably just simpler to just say, hey, he directed the movie.
Right. Like, if you know anything about the movie Tombstone, you know Kurt Russell was the actual director of that movie.
He was.
Uncredited, yeah.
Oh, yeah, the uncredited director. So it happens sometimes where, you know, the person who's credited with directing a film is not always the actual director of the film. But it's kind of weird. When you have a Spielberg-directed movie, you'd think you'd want to really push that out like Spielberg. Or maybe Spielberg didn't think enough of the movie, and he was just kind of like, I like it, but I don't know if I want to put my name on it. You know?
Who knows? So I really enjoyed researching this, and there are a number of other movies that are rumored to be cursed that we could cover in a sequel episode in the future.
Right.
Cool.
I see a little list here.
Yeah, I've got a list here of quite a few of them. So The Crow.
Yeah, I've heard about The Crow curse.
Yeah.
The original Superman.
Yeah, I've heard about that one too because of Margot Kidder.
Margot Kidder, yeah.
And she went crazy and thought she was, well, we could talk about it then.
We talked about this one in a recent episode, Apocalypse Now.
The name of the curse afflicting that movie was Marlon Brando.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Fitzcarraldo, which I haven't seen.
I've never even heard of it.
The Blair Witch Project, rumored to be a cursed film.
Come on, they probably started that rumor themselves.
Probably did. Psycho.
Really?
The Amityville Horror.
Uh-huh.
The Possession, The Conjuring.
Conjuring, right.
The Exorcism of Emily Rose.
Right. I mean, when you put out a movie about possession and demon, like, you pretty much at that point have to fucking come up with some bullshit story about how it was cursed. Sorry.
The Wizard of Oz.
I believe it.
Yeah, I remember there's like some rumors about that film.
Rebel Without a Cause.
Uh-huh.
Roar.
I don't remember. Oh, what's Roar?
A movie I've never seen. The Man Who Killed Don Quixote.
Mm-hmm.
And Tower Heist.
Tower Heist.
I guess if you liked this movie, slap in the comments that you'd like to see a second one, and I'll jump on making another one of these.
Paul, we'll jump on it. Movies. He'll jump on it lickety fucking split. God damn it.
Jump on it right fucking now. Yeah, if you guys want it, just let us know in the comments.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, as for the show today, I've got to go because I've got this script to read.
Yeah, I sent you over a script, Paul.
Yeah, the incomparable Atuk. I'm not sure what that's about, but I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, I think you'd be perfect for the lead.
Perfect. Awesome.
Yeah, Paul's dying to read it.